so grateful to them. I feel embarrassed about getting all this attention. But I think the lesson here is that solidarity is important, and it's our greatest weapon in these times, because they are coming after people. We mentioned Julian Assange. In many ways, he was the test case. What they got away with Julian Assange was utterly deplorable, and it showed that all the pretense of freedom of the press goes out the window when these governments feel, when the empire feels its fundamental interests are threatened. And we've seen it happen with EI, with ASA, with our colleague ASA, with the raid on his home by police. And this is happening more and more. And our best weapon is solidarity and making a fuss, not just for me, but for anyone or everyone who's targeted in this way. That's an important lesson. And solidarity is everywhere. Let me tell you one little story that really warms my heart. In the prison, in the cell, we actually had a window. It was quite a large window of sort of very thick, like almost bulletproof glass. Didn't open, but it looked out onto a courtyard, an internal courtyard, and all around that courtyard were other cells. So that was the only way we could see the other prisoners in the prison. And what they would do, and Mustafa was very keen on this, was they would take the bar of soap that you got. You were issued a little bar of soap about the size of a silver dollar or something. And they would write messages on the window with the soap, and then hold up, and you were also issued a blue towel. And then they'd hold up the blue towel behind the window so that the words would be visible from the outside. And what they would do, mostly exchange messages about where they're from, and, you know, people just kind of giving each other signs. And everyone in that prison, as far as I could tell, everyone was an Arab. Every prisoner was Arab. And the vast majority, I was the odd person out, because everyone was mostly Moroccan or Algerian. And they would like write the names of the towns they're from, Wahran, Fez, Dar al-Bayda. That's what they were exchanging. And Mustafa was very pleased because I was Palestinian. So he wrote on the window that I was Palestinian and then pointed at me. And then all the other prisoners were just giving victory signs and waving. And it was really one of the most touching things I've ever seen. And so that tells you solidarity is everywhere, and solidarity is important.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 inspired various freedom movements worldwide, including in Africa, a continent that endured centuries of colonialism and continues to grapple with new colonialism. This revolution, led by Imam Khomeini, symbolized resistance to Western dominance, particularly against the U.S. and Britain. Its message of self-determination and independence resonated with African nations' struggles against colonial and neocolonial oppression. At the time of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, southern African countries such as South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe were still fighting for liberation from colonial rule. The Islamic Republic of Iran played a significant role in supporting the eventual liberation of these nations. In 1992, Nelson Mandela, a hero of South Africa's liberation struggle, visited the Islamic Republic of Iran 2 years before his election as president. During his arrival in Tehran, Mandela expressed his gratitude, stating, "We are here to thank the Iranian government and nation for their support in the black people's struggle against apartheid." The Islamic Revolution continues to influence the broader anti-colonial movements in Africa. Africa's struggle inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution. Nelson Mandela visited the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1992. Upon his arrival in Tehran, Mandela said, "We are here to thank the Iranian government and nation for their support in the black people's struggle against apartheid." During his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Mandela addressed him as "my leader." During the 16th summit of the Non-Aligned Movement held in Tehran in August 2012, the then Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, met the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. In the meeting, Mugabe said Iran's revolutionary orientation and its avoidance of empty slogans are two of the reasons why freedom-seeking countries of the world were happy about Iran's presidency of the Non-Aligned Movement. This statement clearly reflected the view that most people in Africa view Iran as a country that is indeed serious in combating colonial powers.
Nelson Mandela's statement during his 1992 visit to Tehran reflects the deep ideological connection between Iran's Islamic Revolution and Africa's liberation movements. The Islamic Revolution wasn't merely a political upheaval, but a declaration of resistance against global injustice, colonialism, and systemic oppression. These principles directly parallel South Africa's anti-apartheid struggle.
In its message of condolences following the martyrdom of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, Uganda President said his legacy of dedication and unity will continue to inspire many. Museveni noted that Martyr Raisi was a Shia, but he went to a Sunni mosque, and while there, he met Uganda's Archbishop. President Museveni asserted that the progressive people of Africa are with Iran.
"So I came to assure the Iranian people that we are with you, with the progressive people of Africa. We know who is saying what and why, and we are never fooled by anybody who is playing games."
The statement by President Museveni is viewed as a testament to Iran's Islamic Revolution dedication to unity and progress in Africa.
Well, President Raisi's inclusive actions, such as visiting Sunni mosques and meeting with Christian leaders, tend to exemplify or illustrate the Islamic Revolution's foundational ethos of unity. This gesture, however, goes beyond symbolic outreach. It reaffirms that shared values like justice and equality and human dignity transcend religious or sectarian divisions. Iran has long promoted this message, encouraging unity to resist external exploitation and interference. In Africa, where colonial powers historically weaponized religious and ethnic differences to divide populations, Iran's example is particularly relevant. President Museveni's proposal to memorialize Raisi's meetings with Uganda's Sunni and Christian leaders reflects how such unity can inspire harmony and cooperation. By prioritizing collective strength over division, Iran sets a model for nations navigating the complexities of pluralistic societies. For Africa, this legacy underscores the potential of unity in achieving sovereignty, peace, and development.
Iran supported the Southwest Africa People's Organization, known by its acronym SWAPO, a political party in Namibia and the former independence movement in the country. Iran allowed SWAPO to have diplomatic representation in Tehran. Iran also offered military, educational, and diplomatic support to SWAPO. The current president of Namibia, Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa, as a foreign minister, met the then Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, in 2017. During the meeting, she stated that the relations between the two countries were established even before Namibia's independence, when the country's people were fighting for liberation. She said Iran was among the countries that supported Namibia's independence through backing leaders of the Southwest African People's Organization. Iran's support for Namibia's independence movement was quite significant.
First of all, we will continue to thank the Iranian Revolution for the support that they gave SWAPO during the National Liberation Movement. It was a period of hardship which needed a lot of international support and solidarity. Indeed, it was a fight and a battle against apartheid colonialism. It was a fight against human subjugation. It was a fight against the exploitation of man by colonial forces. It was a fight against racial segregation. It was a fight for the total redemption and liberation of the people of Namibia. The Namibian people, the Namibian liberation struggle gained a lot of support from Iran, yes, in terms of whatever logistical offers were given to the People's Liberation Army of Namibia. And so it was highly significant because they contributed to free a nation under the clutches of imperialism.
Sanctions enforced by imperialist powers against genuinely sovereign nations serve as tools of coercion. In recent times, the use of sanctions has become a common tactic for punishing countries that challenge Western dominance. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, believes that nations such as Iran and Zimbabwe, targeted by Western sanctions, should unite and face this challenge. Mnangagwa made the remarks when he hosted the late Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, in July 2023.
It is critically important that we, the victims of Western sanctions, are talking to each other. The authors of these sanctions would not want us to talk to each other, but because we are both victims, it is clearly important that we show them that we are united.
Sanctions were imposed on Iran immediately after the Islamic Revolution and have continued to evolve over the last 45 years. Iran has been able to turn sanctions into an opportunity to develop. The unity between Zimbabwe and Iran is critical in resisting sanctions and attaining self-sufficiency in various sectors. Iran, a role model for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Alliance of Sahel States, comprising Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, was established in September 2023 to address regional instability and security threats. This anti-colonial alliance draws strategic inspiration from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Sahel Alliance leaders are particularly influenced by Iran's sustained resistance to international pressure and its ability to build regional influence through ideological alignment, self-reliance, and strategic partnerships. They admire Iran's use of asymmetric strategies, grassroots mobilization, and emphasis on sovereignty to counter global powers. The alliance aims to resist external interference and tackle shared challenges, including terrorism and economic instability, more effectively. Mali's Defense Minister, Sadio Camara, stated during a visit to Iran in May 2023 that his country is determined to assert sovereignty over its borders and take full control of its security. He further remarked that the Islamic Republic of Iran serves as a role model in this regard. How does the Islamic Republic of Iran serve as a role model for countries that are striving to establish genuine independence? Since the early years of South Africa's post-apartheid democracy, significant pressure was placed on the country's founding president, Nelson Mandela, by Western imperialist powers, particularly by the United States, regarding his stance on various issues. Each time, Mandela stood his ground, firmly asserting South Africa's independence. In 1996, the then Iranian president, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, visited South Africa and was warmly received by Mandela. In a news conference following their meeting, President Mandela defended his country's strong ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran and categorically stated that South Africa would not accept being told which countries could be its friends.
But we form our friendships on the basis of principle. And those who are with us when we're all alone will continue to be our friend. And the fact that any particular country may be their enemies does not influence our attitude. We are a sovereign and independent country, and we're prepared to defend that sovereignty and independence. And no country can dictate to us.
The message of Nelson Mandela was a pointer to the role the victory of the Islamic Revolution had on the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Western imperialist powers have long sought to isolate Iran in Africa, but have failed dismally, as many countries in the continent have maintained their non-aligned policy. African countries ignored calls by Western powers and the Zionist regime and maintained cordial ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Nelson Mandela said something that was right. No other nation is supposed to dictate to another one as to who should be a friend. The Iranian revolution has her own characteristics. The Iranian revolution has proven to be a progressive revolution and not a stagnant revolution like many other revolutions that we have seen all over the world. In the relationship of one country to another, no other country should be like a policeman to say, don't relate to this or that. Countries in Africa are sovereign states and have the right to decide who they should relate with.
Niger's revolutionary government recently cut military ties with France and the United States. This decision was made amid the country's determination to assert its independence. Niger's Prime Minister, Lamine Zane, says the termination of military cooperation and bilateral relations between his country and the United States was due to American threats and Washington's opposition to the African nation's partnership with Iran and Russia. During his visit to Iran in January 2024, he met the then Iran's president, Martar Ebrahim Raisi, and described Iran as a reliable partner for Niger. The revolutionary government of Niger views Iran as a reliable partner and not France or the United States.
Niger's decision to strengthen ties with Iran instead of traditional partners like France, quite a controversial partnership or relationship at that, and the United States reflects a broader rejection of neo-colonial relationships. Historically, Western powers have maintained an influence because of these neo-colonial relationships through exploitative practices, resource extraction, and of course, the devastating impact of military presence and escapades often at the expense of local sovereignty and economic development. In contrast, I would say that Iran approaches partnerships based on mutual respect and shared development goals. Iran's focus on non-interference and support for infrastructure, technology transfer, innovation, and education aligns with Niger's aspirations for self-reliance.
The second Iran and Africa International Economic Conference was held last April in Tehran with the objective of boosting economic ties with African countries. The event was attended by the then-president, Martar Ebrahim Raisi, and high-ranking representatives from over 30 African countries. On the sidelines of the second Iran-Africa International Conference, the then-prime minister of Burkina Faso met and talked with Martar Raisi and said, "Contrary to Western propaganda, Iran is an independent, developing, and advanced country that adds to its attractiveness to develop and strengthen relations with in all fields. This is a very critical point that African countries are no longer paying attention to Western propaganda."
So the remarks by Burkina Faso's prime minister highlights a transformative shift in Africa's global outlook. Historically, Western, or should I say corporate, propaganda has portrayed nations like Iran as isolated or regressive or aggressive. But African leaders are increasingly basing their judgments on direct experience with Iran and other countries and direct engagement. During the second Iran-Africa International Conference, African leaders witnessed Iran's achievements in science, technology, and transfer, and infrastructure in particular, clear proof of its progress despite decades of sanctions and international pressure. This seems to have created a culture of resilience. This rejection of Western narratives symbolizes Africa's growing confidence in its ability to assess partnerships independently and on its own strength. Iran's independence and self-reliance resonates deeply with African nations, and of course, vice versa, striving to break free from colonial dependency. As African nations prioritize sovereignty and development over external approval, they are creating alliances with nations like Iran that embody these values. This shift represents a broader realignment in global politics, where Africa is asserting its agency and embracing relationships that respect, truly respect, its aspirations.
The Alliance of Sahel States is a confederation of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso that has boldly rejected foreign militarization and neocolonial domination. These three countries that enjoy popular support have resolved to strengthen ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran because they view the Islamic Revolution as an inspiration. Pan-Africanists are calling for further strengthening the common bonds between the Islamic Revolution and Africa.
The military cooperation between Africa and Iran in terms of training, support, and logistics need to continue, and then for Africa to remain strong in her own military strides. Any foreign military base in Africa is in a way diluting the sovereignty of that country. Why is it that Africa do not have military bases in the US or in Europe? Why is it that Africa do not have that? But they rather come in. Why? It's because of one thing, to have dominance on our mineral resources and to exploit. That is all. And so when it comes to the military advancement, military strength, military potency of Iran is something that should be shared with African states as best practices. Exchange of military lessons or experiences is far better between sovereign states than one state to come and then situate a whole military base in that country.
limelight.
The Trump administration has ordered U.S. states to suspend a $5 billion electric vehicle charging station program in a further blow to the environmental movement. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Trump administration has ordered U.S. states to suspend a $5 billion electric vehicle charging station program in a further blow to the environmental movement since the president's return to the White House. In a memo issued on Thursday, 6th of February, to state transportation directors, the Transportation Department's Federal Highway Administration ordered states not to suspend any funds allocated to them under the Biden administration as part of the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. Emily Biondi, the Federal Highway Administration's Associate Administrator for Planning, Environment and Realty, wrote in the memo, "The new leadership of the Department of Transportation has decided to review the policies underlying the implementation of the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program." Emily Biondi added, "Accordingly, the current National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program, dated June 11, 2024, and all prior versions of this guidance are rescinded." She wrote, "As a result of rescission of the NEVI Formula Program guidance, the Federal Highway Administration is also immediately suspending the approval of all state electric vehicle infrastructure deployment plans for all fiscal years. Therefore, effective immediately, no new obligations may occur under the NEVI Formula Program until the updated fiscal NEVI Formula Program guidance is issued and new state plans are submitted and approved." Emily Biondi added that until new guidance is issued, reimbursement of existing obligations for designing and building charging stations will be allowed in order to prevent the disruption of current financial commitments. According to an existing page on the Energy Department's website, the NEVI program provides funding to states to strategically deploy electric vehicle chargers. Funding is available for up to 80% of eligible project costs, including the acquisition, installation, and network connection of electric vehicle chargers, proper operation and maintenance of electric vehicle chargers, and long-term electric vehicle charger data sharing. The website Politico reports that as of Thursday, 6th of February, the FHWA removed several website pages that provided information on the NEVI program. In a statement to the website Politico, Andrew Rogers, the former deputy FHWA administrator under the Biden administration, said that the memo appears to ignore both the law and multiple restraining orders that have been issued by federal courts. The outlet further reports that Andrew Rogers, saying that the memo appears to be in direct violation of the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, a law that restricts presidents from withholding congressionally approved funding. According to Electric Vehicle States Clearinghouse, currently 14 states have at least one operational electric vehicle station. According to a NEVI report, as of last November, there are 126 public charging ports in operation across 31 NEVI stations in 9 states, marking an 83% increase in open NEVI ports since last quarter. It added that a total of 41 states have released at least their first round of solicitations, with 35 having issued conditional awards or put agreements in place for more than 3,560 fast-charging ports across more than 890 charging station locations. Throughout his campaign, Donald Trump railed against electric vehicles, at one point saying that supporters of the vehicles should rot in hell, and that Joe Biden's support for electric vehicles would bring a bloodbath to the United States' automotive industry. Last month, as part of a flurry of executive orders he signed during his first days back in office, Donald Trump revoked a Biden-era order from 2021 that had aimed to make half of all new vehicles sold in the United States by 2030 electric vehicles. The website of Press Reader has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump's attempts to slash incentives for electric cars would cause sales of the vehicles to plummet, with this effort cheered on by the seemingly confounding supporter Elon Musk, the billionaire chief executive of Tesla. Trump has said that he will revoke the electric vehicle mandate, saving our auto industry and keeping my sacred pledge to our great American auto workers. President Trump, who previously suggested supporters of electric vehicles rot in hell before somewhat tempering his rhetoric, has already ditched an aspirational goal for half of all car sales to be electric vehicles by the end of the decade, halted some funding for electric vehicle chargers, and began reversing vehicle pollution standards that prod auto companies to shift away from gasoline models. A key tax credit for Americans buying an electric vehicle worth up to $7,500 is also a major target for elimination, although to overturn this, Donald Trump will require Republicans in Congress. Should he succeed, though, the impact would be significant, with a current study finding that electric car sales could fall by as much as 27% without the incentive. Joseph Shapiro, a University of California at Berkeley economist and co-author of the study, said, "Turning off the credit would affect a meaningful share of electric vehicle market," adding that while a growing number of people would still go electric, the total number of cars sold would shrink by more than 300,000 a year than if the incentive stayed in place. Joseph Shapiro added, "You could say that it would be a speed bump in the road, but if the US goes all electric in 2090 rather than 2050, say, that matters a lot for the planet. A lot of carbon would be emitted in that time." Donald Trump's agenda has been enthusiastically backed by Elon Musk, despite the market-leading electric vehicle company Tesla that also relies upon some parts made in China that may be targeted by tariffs imposed by Trump. Though Elon Musk has said that removal of electric vehicle subsidies will hurt rivals such as Ford and General Motors more than Tesla. Elon Musk wrote on X, "Take away the subsidies. It will only help Tesla." Joseph Shapiro claimed, "There is some logic to this. Tesla is comfortably the largest electric vehicle brand in the United States, accounting for nearly half of all sales, and makes more profit per car than its rivals, meaning the removal of incentives would be disproportionately felt by other electric vehicle manufacturers." Joseph Shapiro added, "If the tax credit is removed, Tesla could survive and have less competition. They have more headroom to withstand a decrease in the market size." Stocks in Tesla surged following Donald Trump's election win. However, Tesla will still be affected. For example, weakening federal pollution rules could see a reduction in the amount of carbon credits Tesla sells to other car companies, amounting to $2.7 billion just last year, to offset their emissions and avoid fines. Tesla sales dipped slightly for the first time in 2024 amid concerns among some of its traditionally liberal customer base about Elon Musk's rightward political turn.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
According to an October 2024 report issued by the International Labour Organization, the unemployment rate in Gaza had risen to nearly 80% during the Zionist regime genocide, and the gross domestic product had been reduced by almost 85%. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, 15-year-old Mahmoud Saleh never imagined that he would one day pull a cart intended for a donkey to earn income for his family. But after his father was killed in an Israeli regime military attack on his carpentry workshop in Gaza City in August 2023, and Saleh's donkey died in a subsequent shelling, he felt he had no other option. Saleh had been forced to flee with his mother, two younger brothers, and two sisters to the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunis, carrying with him memories of loss and the burdens of poverty. He did not want his mother earning money by washing other people's clothes by hand, as she had been doing to the power outages since the Zionist regime's attacks began on October 7, 2023. Saleh borrowed money from an uncle to buy a donkey-drawn cart and used it to transport water to the camps for around $11 a day. With the donkey now dead, Saleh ties a rope around his waist every morning around 7 and pulls the cart loaded with water to the camps for the displaced. During a short break from his work on January 11th, Saleh said, "The young men and passerby often take pity on me and help me push the cart from the back. I wish I could be in school with my friends now, but I have become a man before my time." He said, "I don't have the luxury of dreams. All I think about is how to feed my mother and my younger siblings." But due to the destruction caused by the Israeli regime attacks, it is doubtful that there would be a non-home-based school for Saleh and his friends to go to, even if he had the time to attend classes. At least 625,000 students in the Gaza Strip have been deprived of resuming their education, according to UN experts, as more than 80% of Gaza's schools have been destroyed or damaged in the Zionist regime's attacks. Isa Al-Khati, a displaced resident in Nuseirat, also pulls a card with his hands to earn money. He transports goods and passengers in and around the town's main market in the central Gaza Strip. Al-Khatib said he used to work in construction in the north, but after the Zionist regime's attacks began, he and his family were displaced in May 2023 and he needed new work. With his savings, Al-Khatib bought a horse and a cart and began transporting passengers and goods in Nuseirat. However, the death of his horse in a traffic accident forced him to take his place. Al-Khatib told the Electronic Intifada, "The horse used to save me this suffering. Now I feel like I'm slowly dying every day while pulling this cart." He said he could not afford to buy another horse. Al-Khatib said, "Before the war, a horse cost about $600, and today its price has reached $3,000. Business is slow," he said, "in part because many people see his taking the place of a horse as degrading, but he insisted he had little choice." Al-Khatib said, "Sometimes passerby take pity on me and give me some money for the free." The unemployment rate in Gaza had risen to nearly 80% during the Zionist regime genocide, and the gross domestic product has been reduced by almost 85%, according to an October 2024 report issued by the International Labour Organization. Ismail Thawabta, director of the government media office, told the Electronic Intifada, "Israel's prevention of fuel from entering Gaza has caused a comprehensive humanitarian disaster." He said that this humanitarian disaster has taken the form of the breakdown of vehicles, forcing residents to resort to primitive means such as carts as primary means of transportation. He said, "What is even more painful is that this war has forced many young men and children to work pulling these carts after losing their animals due to repeated Israeli raids. This, in turn, increases their physical and psychological suffering." Thawabta called on the international community to pressure the Zionist regime to stop its aggressive policies and allow the urgent entry of fuel to avoid further deterioration in the lives of Palestinians in Gaza.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
We've all been there and done that, that our child, our youth, our Sunday school kid comes up to us, maybe when they're 6 years old-ish. What did they tell you or ask you? They say, "How come I cannot see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? I want to see Allah." Now the problem, you know, is this, that we have an answer to that. But when the kids are a little too young to understand the deeper answers, we kind of get stuck. That's the hard part. And they think you don't have an answer. Now God forbid you're a Mawlana too. They look at you, they say, "Aren't you Mawlana?" And so you say, "Yeah." They say, "Well, you should know everything. You should know the answer to everything." Yeah? It happens all the time. All right, so we know what's going on. Now, we'll tell our kids that, we'll give them an answer. Our Sunday school kids, our own kids, will give them an answer. But deep down inside, we're smiling and we're thinking to ourselves that we know what the problem is. Because as a child, Allah has put us in this world, right? And we have grown accustomed to the five senses that we have. The way we register knowledge and information is through these five senses and the experiences we have through them. So we want everything to go by these five senses. That which can be sensed by the five senses exists. That which cannot be sensed doesn't exist. That is our mentality growing up. We are put in this world of cause and effect. And so the cause of my success will be money, will be relationships, will be my work, and so on. Will be my own knowledge, my own smarts. Like Qarun said, إِنَّمَا أُوتِيتُهُ عَلَىٰ عِلْمٍ عِنْدِي. Qarun, in the time of Musa, he got in big trouble because he had a lot of wealth. But he kept telling the people, he told the people that, yes, I was given this and I was able to achieve this because of a knowledge that I have. Taking Allah out of the equation. When we're put in this world, brothers and sisters, we're put into this world, Allah has something in mind when He puts us here. He puts us into this world, we grow accustomed to the cause and effect, which is there. It is a reality. But the purpose of all of this seems to be that Allah wants us to grow slowly out of this understanding. That's why He's given us a lifetime for this. I'm not going to expect this from a 10-year-old, from a 15-year-old, from a 20-year-old, from a 30-year-old even. But slowly when you get a little older, like myself, and you're looking and you can see the end coming closer and closer, it's time to start waking up to the reality that Allah is also part of the equation. Cause and effect is there. The five senses are there. What I register through these five senses is true. But there's more to it than that. Yes. And so we're given this lifetime so that we can grow out of this. Now some people, they reach 40, 50, 60, they're still like that child that was asking that question in the beginning of the lecture. For example, the Bani Israel, they were all adults, yet they were struggling with this problem that they were still looking at these things very superficially and in a childish way. I want to share three verses of the Quran that illustrate this. What are we talking about again? Talking about that kid who comes up to me and says, I want to see God. How come I can't see God? And I want to segue, use that as a segue to into our topic tonight, which has to do with Imam Zaman alayhi salam. So, these three verses, one of them is Surah Al-A'raf, verse 138. وَجَاوَزْنَا بِبَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ الْبَحْرِ. The biggest miracle. Like one of the biggest miracles. We crossed the Bani Israel, across the Red Sea. And so, after seeing this miracle, I mean, you would expect that they remember that for a while. Apparently, they forgot, or they're a little too childish deep down inside. So, what did they say? Right when they cross, they come to the other side. The grass is greener on the other side. Pun is kind of intended there. So, they come on the other side. They see that there are people there. There are people there who are worshipping idols. What did they say? فأتوا على قوم يعكفون على أصنام لهم قالوا يا موسى أو موسى موسى موسى. You know, I'm reading it in a childish tone, but these are adults we're talking about. We're just put behind them one of the biggest miracles of Allah. أو موسى أو موسى اجعل لنا إلها كما لهم آلهة. Face palm. Give us a Lord the way they have a Lord. Prophet Musa is saying, like probably thinking to himself, like, we just split the gosh darn sea, and now you're asking for a God that just like they have a God. Don't you think a God did that for you? That's why I read it in a childish tone. That's one. They want to see Allah, just like these people are seeing their God and worshiping it, which is an idol. Or another verse, they say that when Prophet Musa went to meet his Lord, he took with him some people. Those people had a demand. And so Prophet Musa, on their behalf, had to ask Allah and request Allah this request. What is the request? Rabbi arini anzur ilayk. Oh Allah, show yourself to me so I can see you with this physical eye. And right away Allah says, lan tarani, you'll never see me. Walakin unzur ilal jabal. You're really interested in seeing me? Trust me, it's not good for you. Keep this in mind. It's not good for you. Maybe it's better if you don't see me. Why? Unzur ilal jabal. Look at the mountain. فَإِنْ إِسْتَقَرَّ مَكَانَهُ فَسَوْفَ تَرَانِي. If it stays in its place, then you'll see me. In other words, you can't. This is rhetorical here. What he's telling him, Allah is telling him, is rhetorical. Meaning you're not going to be able to look. The mountain will not be able to handle this greatness of me, let alone you and your physical eye. فلما تجلى ربه للجبل جعله دكا. We all know the story, right? Allah manifested upon the mountain. The mountain was destroyed. فخر موسى صعيقا. Musa passes out, and we know till the end what happened. All right. Rabbi arini anzur ilayk. I want to look at you. No, maybe it's not possible. Maybe there's something in it for you to not be able to see me. Lan tarani. Allah brought us here so we grow and put behind us this childish understanding of I want to see God. Another verse. Oh, that was Surah Araf 143, the second verse. The third one, Surah Nisa 153. يَسْأَلُكَ أَهْلُ الْكِتَابِ أَن تُنَزِّلَ عَلَيْهِمْ كِتَابًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ. The Ahlul Kitab of your time, O Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they're asking you to send down a book, to bring a book for them, upon them, reveal it unto them. Like the Quran is not enough, they're asking for a book for themselves. Don't worry, Prophet. Did you know their ancestors asked for something greater than that? What did they ask for? فَقَدْ سَأَلُوا مُوسَىٰ أَكْبَرْ مِنْ ذَلِكَ. They asked Musa something greater, أكبر. What was it? فَقَالُوا أَرِنَ اللَّهَ جَهْرَةً. Show us Allah in the open. Right? Okay. So you can still be a child when you're 50, 60 years old. The point is, brothers and sisters, for us to come here to slowly understand and reach a point that through our obedience to Allah, through our servitude to Allah, reach a point, inshallah, through reciting Quran all the time, reflecting, reminding, I don't need to see him for him to exist. Yeah? Trust me. If a person sees Allah with the eye of the heart, it'll be worth more than seeing him with the physical eye. Yeah? And that's why they say, and this is where the connection between this whole matter of Allah and the Imams or the Prophet comes into the picture. How many people saw the Prophet in his lifetime but went against him and questioned him on the most basic things for God's sake? They sit in the presence of the Prophet, stretching their legs out, or, you know, laying on their stomachs and bellies and saying, Ya Rasulullah, qussana, tell us stories. Like, don't you know in whose presence you're in? Ayatullah Bahjat, in Salat, every time he would reach the parts of Salat that the Prophet's name is mentioned, he would weep. Like, he understands a little bit, maybe, the greatness of this individual. These people are seeing the Prophet. It's not about the physical aspect of things. Allah wants us to grow out of all of this. And so, what we'll tell that child, if we can tell them anything, is the same way when Allah is everywhere, that's why you cannot see him, and so we see him with the heart, just like Ali ibn Abi Talib taught us when that individual asked him, do you see your Lord when you worship him? And Imam Ali gave the famous answer that we all know. He said, woe unto you, the eyes of the face don't see him. لَا تُدْرِكُهُ الْعُيُونَ فِي مُشَاهِدَةِ الْأَبْصَارِ. We can't see him with the eyes that see things, but rather, رَأَتْهُ الْقُلُوبَ. The hearts see him. See Allah with, well, how do they see him? What do they see of him? بِحَقَائِقِ الْإِيمَانِ. With the faith that you have. In other words, there is another sense in addition to the five senses. What is the sixth sense? It is the sense of Iman.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
صلى الله عليه.
standing tall. I feel abandoned, stand elevated, blessed by the prophets, led by the greatest, and peace it was promised. Can you hear my cry? Can you feel my hurt? One day the sun will rise over this land. Al-Aqsa and peace goes hand in hand. This is our home. It is our right. Yes, Allah knows. It's our Palestine. Can you hear my cry? Can you feel my hurt? One day the sun this land of love. Ya Aqsa, hubuka fi qalbi, samihni ya Aqsa.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pro-justice demonstrators calling on British court to drop the charges against a man they believe was unjustly arrested and charged.
I'm here to support Chris Nyhem. I think I've got the right to protest, as everybody has in a democratic, so-called democratic society. I think it's appalling what's happening.
I was on that demonstration with Chris. We broke no laws. This is an attempt to shut down the right to demonstrate. In particular, to shut down the right to demonstrate about the outrage in Gaza.
Here's the backstory. Chris Nyhem, the founder of the anti-war group Stop the War Coalition, seen here, was apprehended and later released during a pro-Palestine march in central London on January 18th. That prompted clashes between demonstrators and the Metropolitan Police, who handcuffed 77 of them under the so-called Public Orders Act. Legislation that the demonstrators here say has given police too many powers.
Police have been granted excessive powers, which are a threat to the right to free assembly, and that is a fault in the legislation, and it's a fault in the way in which the police are applying the legislation. They've overstepped the mark, even that a bad piece of law gave them.
The reason behind the whole episode, the Met's reversal on an agreement with the Palestine Solidarity Demonstration organizers, with plan to march from the BBC building to Whitehall, where the government offices are located. The Met's justification, purported disruptions to a synagogue in the vicinity of the public broadcaster.
there's been no evidence of any threat to any